Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
pandalins. Now, I'm going to talk about this particular creature because it's just so amazing, and I suppose it's almost wrong of me to do so, because what I've learnt is just from watching a documentary narrated by David Attenborough, of course, and you can't get any better than that. Just to show you a directional microphone, I'm just going to point out this dog. Okay, well, fortunately, you don't have to hear this dog as much as I do late at night. Okay, yeah, pandalins. Certainly the weirder animals in Australia really fascinate me. The koala, the platypus, the echidna. Yeah, just amazing. So the echidna is our version of the hedgehog, called the spiny anteater. And it's pretty amazing in that its back feet point backwards. And it's just, it walks on its back knuckles, and it's just really amazing animal to see. And it's got a beak. I mentioned this because pandalins are just, right up there. It's actually sort of swamped it. So pandalins, roughly a metre long, low to the ground. And the amazing thing about them, there's a beautiful warmth coming through the air. Sort of cold, but warmth coming through the air. Today it got up to, I think, supposedly 24 degrees here, more at 20 degrees. But getting back into pandalins, they're the only mammal with scales. And that is similar to, I think, fish scales. It's out of keratin, or the scales that you have. I mean, birds have scales, but only on their legs. And there's a sort of a thing to prepare chicken feet. You have to actually heat it up, and the scales or the fingernails, which sort of cover the entire bottom of the chicken feet, get washed off. So there's special chicken feet machine to remove this thing called keratin, which is in your fingernails, and essentially their body is festooned with fingernails, and they have got basically a probing snout. Like, they don't really basically have a head, they basically just have a snout with the eyes on it and scales going back. So this is pretty amazing. It's the only known mammal that is a placental animal, which has external breastfeeding. So you have mammals, and mammals you have placentals, marsupials, and monotremes. So monotremes are your platypus, echidna. They lay eggs and secrete milk, not out of a teat. So it's sort of getting close on placentals, who also secrete external milk, whereas marsupials have their young in the pouch. That's sort of solving different sorts of problems. And so these are placental animals, mammals. So they give birth to live young and feed them. And instead of having hair or skin or spines, they have hedgehogs and echidna, the Australian version of a hedgehog, sort of like a giant super mobile hedgehog, is this pandalin. And so it's got this scale, and got sort of a elongated body, but a massive, very thick, heavy tail, where the heavy tail is pretty much the same size and length as the rest of the body. And so they've got about a centre of mass which sits over their hind legs. And what this means is that they tuck up their front legs into their body and just walk around like a human. And so this is just the greatest thing. It's sort of like, they just look so human walking around the place. They walk like you and me, except they've got a long, flat body going forward and counterbalanced by a tail going backwards. And so this is the great thing about pandalids. So absolutely adorable. And there's about four breeds in Africa, and then a few breeds in India across to Southeast Asia. So that's their range. They're not in North America or Australia. That's the range, obviously, in sort of the hotter areas. Now, thing is that although there's reasonable populations in Africa, they're a food delicacy and a Chinese medicine delicacy, and so there's this just huge demand from them from China. So it's part of the wealth of China growing up, means that they are able to extract more of these animals, and so you have them all endangered. And what's going is that they've got a fairly substantial extraction process, and they might intercept up to 10% of the animals and return those 10% to the wild. But of course, one doesn't realise sort of once it goes up that they're harvesting pretty well the entire population. The population is going to crash, and they're all critically endangered. So all these pandalins are beautiful animals. So they've got excavation claws on the front, and basically like tiny little toddler legs which move them about the place, and they walk around the place. And it's just so amazing to see an animal which actually does that. And so I suppose look it up or watch this particular documentary. I'll give a bit of a talk on it. I suppose the thing that Australia is always, ambivalent about, in that we have a huge trading partner in China. We're basically we're giving the iron ore to China and all that type of stuff. And we've had an experience of selling resources to Japan before World War II, and realizing, perhaps we shouldn't have done that. Again, with China, it's sort of like, in a family where you've got the breadwinner and they come home drunk, you tend to make excuses for them. But if they're sort of the oldest or old unmarried daughter and they come home drunk, it's a whole other type of thing. So sort of we tend to have a lot of difficulty in talking about human rights or things like this. And invariably, it's just cutting across that there seems to be an array of arguments that you can follow, but an array of people involved who don't have the belief structures which work across it. So if you're believing that you can pandal in scales, which is imported by the ton, and involves of I think they estimate there's 100,000 pandalins removed from the wild each year. You have this horrible equation that if you look at the actual process, it's this high information process. It is obviously, if someone's in a restaurant and it's they're serving pandalin, who knows what else they're going to serve on that thing, and there's this deeply ingrained culture, that sort of person suddenly going to say, I won't eat it. So it's perhaps, I suppose, targeting the younger generation to know about it. And it essentially, it's pretty well for every wild animal, the process of it's not that we shouldn't be harvesting pandalins, but perhaps any wild animal that goes there. So sort of, what does this all mean? And of course, in this age of molecular chemistry, CRISPR and all this type of stuff, the idea is becoming even more and more absurd that a particular scale from an animal, because of a legend and a story, there's sort of like no controlled trials and tests like that. And even if there were, the people involved in that area go across, and it's sort of, I don't know, it's infectious sentimentalism in that the people, I in general find that the people who can wave through this type of stuff and sort of accept that other cultures are going to exert a power on the rest of the world and they can't control it or anything like that, they can stamp down on it, but not really. If I can only just say, like, we shouldn't cast the first stone, but I remember at one stage I was fated by the sort of regional high-up people in the Communist Party, and they took me to Chinese banquet, and they were all gagging on this very hot Sichuan food. There's a bit of a story to it. And Chairman Mao liked his food hot, and so back in the Chinese Communist Party, they all had to have the super hot food. But I, in the banquet, had to eat various things, and there was this thing I just chewed and chewed and chewed. I couldn't get through it. It was a cow's aorta, so I had to eat the heart. So, and there's a lot of cultures where sort of the symbolism goes through. And it's just that we, you know, we're at a stage of the pantry of our planet is bare. We've got to go through it. My overall view is that people who wave this type of thing through are at the same time waving their own excesses through in terms of backhand deals to developers and what I can say, it's the story of candor. So look, there's lots of things that we in the West doing correctly, but I really feel the issue boils. So what's happening is these delightful creatures, and the other great thing is that the creature has a defense mechanism of rolling themselves up in a ball when threatened, which is great. So the poachers just simply pick them up and put them in a bag, and that's it. See what it is. But these creatures are so affectionate, they actually sit and ride on the top of their carer's back, and it's just so adorable in that that aspect. And there's sort of this very what appears to be very sophisticated behaviour with the carers. Now, this is one of these sort of stranger things, is that it's a bit like Dr. Doolittle, but animal behaviour really changes with there seems to be first encounter outliers. So I know people who have looked after Tasmanian devils, and they've had just fantastic affectionate times with them. But anybody else, there's something that they did in the process which hasn't followed something, and has allowed that bond to happen. But also I find that people who are handling a large number of animals, this, we have wires which basically there's a series of things that they only handle native animals. And so if it's a non-native animal, good luck to you. If it's a native animal, they do look after it. But they handle such a large number of animals of different species that occasionally they come up with a very affectionate possum or a very affectionate bird, which won't, which for some reason appears to have almost human properties. Now, so your wires, wild rescue something or other service. I don't know what it means. Wild injured. I don't know what it stands for, but they go through this sequence of a large number of animals. RSPCA deals with, I suppose, animals. However, they have this thing that they won't handle livestock, which we can sort of almost understand it in terms of that they'll come up and look after a dog or a cat or something. I don't know what the story is, but if it's a goat or a sheep or a pig, they won't do it because we eat those sorts of things. So it's so deeply, deeply confused and conflicted. So that's my story on the pandalin, and I'm pleased that I've just seen that for the first time. Enjoy. I hope I have given a reasonable wrap of this amazing animal and the sort of tension that this culture isn't our own, which is destroying it. So it's not the Japanese eating whales or various things. Now, on the other hand, it should be said that there are some animals we should eat. I hate to say it, kangaroos. Kangaroos per kilo of meat has something like 2% of the carbon footprint, simply because their digestive system is more recent than the cow one. The cow one has archaic bacteria. Our kangaroos have different type of bacteria. They don't produce methane. So when they eat, they've got a very low carbon footprint, very low cholesterol, very low fat. It's sort of like a little bit hard to farm them because they can bound out of the place and stuff like that. But they do quickly. I mean, the problem of stocking and restocking. So what happens is in Australia there's a drought, and then it builds up to a few good years. And towards the end there are really good years, and then you've got massive destocking. So when a drought first hits, the price of meat falls dramatically as they destock the national herd. And all that type of stuff, but the clearing, yeah, that's probably, there are certain animals which should be farmed. I perhaps think that the knock-on consequences, and I think we as a race will basically should stop eating wild animals. That's my overall thought. Thanks a lot for listening. On to pH meters for the Internet of Things project. So in general, the idea quite simply is that you have a box with a battery power source. The battery power source is upgraded now from an expensive mobile phone battery to a bit more beefy computer power supply device, and dollar for dollar, it's just probably 100 times. It's got several hundred hours worth of power already, and sort of there's no issue with it, and it charges supremely quickly, whereas a mobile phone battery takes a while to do this. Charges supremely quickly. But that being said, what is the aim? Is that you have a box which you open up, and then you stick the measurements in and go log into your web page to see what exactly is happening. And it just makes the thing that you have there, takes the data, puts it to the internet, and then computers can come in and calibrate and work out things are going on. So basically I've got the temperature probe, and I'll just have a bit of a talk about the temperature probes later on, but we have the pH meter, and the pH meter is fairly simple. You put in two voltages, and 0 to 5 volts or whatever it is, and it takes that and then converts, depending on the pH of the solution. You have a little bulb, and a very thin wall glass bulb with ions diffusing through it, And so that's sitting in a solution all the time. So in terms of sensors, it, you know, has to be washed and then put in your solution. So you've got a little, basically a probe with a bulb in it, and the bulb goes into your solution. Now, well, what has to be washed is that if you've got a very strong acid and you put it into your solution, you wreck your storage solution. The reason it needs a storage solution is that it's all the time pulling ions through glass. Now, this is a strange thing. The glass does not emit electrons, but it can, very thin, emit ions. Now, this is a strange thing to say. Surely electrons are small. No, electrons are quite big, and they require a periodic structure to travel, to have an orbital that they travel through. Whereas ions can actually just move through small pores and stuff like that. And so, to get a pH meter, and you only really need one, it's just three wires and analog input. Now, sort of you say, it's hard to say. It's you're going to a destination, and one's a seaside destination, one's a hill destination, one's by lakes, and to how we're going to get there. So there's one way where you can get very lightweight electronics, 3.3 volts, and then you then have to get a voltage converter to set up at 5 volts to run your pH meter, or you can have a breakout board, which is basically an analog to digital converter, which sits near your component. Now, the analog, so these pH meters are really a bit of a blast from the past, in that at some stage it would be very easy to sit an ADD converter really up close. So an analog to digital converter converts a battery voltage into a binary number. So it's sort of a battery voltage, if you imagine, it's like a needle moving up, and a binary number is actually a digital number. The advantage of a digital number is that it can travel freely and uncorrupted, whereas a analog signal has all these things on the top of it. But for kiddies, so for some reason, it's gone down this path. I don't understand quite why. And essentially, a low-cost pH meter is analog, and going through sort of selecting components, once you move away from the ESP, where the actual processes on your internet communication, and break it up, you move into slightly larger boards. So the smallest board is they fit the size of a credit card. The other one is possibly say three, four. Possibly, if you've got four credit cards put together in a row, that's the size of the other board, and it's still sort of like microscopic. Yeah, I think it would be probably four, three and a half together. And this is the so you can have a cut down board, which is two and a half credit cards, and then you add another credit card to it. That extra credit card length is all your breakout boards. And so once that's there, you've just you've got hundreds of outputs. So you go from so it doesn't scale well with price. What happens is you pay, say, $25 for the really small skinny one, because in your mind you've got sort of a certain things. You want low power rating, you want it to run mobile things, perhaps you want to put it in a mobile device, something like that, you go small. But if you back off and buy the 100 outputs, it's only $10. So what is it, 10 cents an output, if you really want to put it that way. And so that's the Arduino Mega. And that just has analog, 5 volts. So it's for all the things, it's the thing to obviously go. And so it's cheaper and provides everything and works amazingly reliable. And so I have the pH meter, and there's all this software you can do that if you want to actually have an LED display of the pH next to your Arduino, you have to do certain things. You have to calibrate it, then press a button on the Arduino to tell it to move through these different steps and stuff like that. Of course, we're not going to do that. We're going to have this as a box, and it communicates to the internet. So what happens is that it just live streams to the internet your analog to digital signal. Your calibration factor really is your own business, and it can just basically work out historically what the different units are. So you can go back and say, historically, say this section is pH of 7. This is the buffer solution, which has got a pH of something else. So what actually happened to me, or what I have to say, is that I took the buffer solution up and then inverted it. So you've got a bulb, and it screws into a container. I unscrewed the container and then inverted it, pouring the buffer solution on my knee, which is not a good thing to do. And you know, getting the lifetime is great. And of course, the buffer solution, I went on the internet and said, oh, can I make one out of my stuff in the kitchen? So you need distilled water. So you don't need deionized water, you need lots of ions. And you need about 3 molar of sodium chloride. So that I would expect that would basically load the system with ion exchange. So it would be mobile for, say, potassium. I don't know whether potassium is all that mobile in thin glass, but it would basically load up your glass in this solution. So eventually the glass would equilibrate, say, so the glass could take in other ions or stuff like that, but the ions would sort of displace the potassium ions in and create a current and that type of stuff. So you need that solution, and you also need a fungicide in it to make it. So fortunately I've just got some contact at school. I've asked my friend to nab a little bit for me, because I wasn't able to make it up there, and I just thought, oh, so that's just one mistake. And but I've got the pH meter working in, and brilliantly high speed. And so I'm just trying to work out basically how to actually manage these things. So to get the rate up, and the responsiveness up, and just try and work out what exactly is going on here to work it out. So the pH solution, the pH meter, has a responsiveness within really a fraction of a second, a 20th of a second. You can see the pH just zip up. And it takes a while to, you can see it change and move up. And so there's this process here. Now, one thinks that you basically, I don't know, it's a washing and storing solutions, and there's the idea that you can store the solution. It really bodes, this is something that the Arduino should do, is perhaps suck in the solution. So when it's there and stand it up, it's detected that the meter is in, it pours out the solution, and then sucks in the solution to contain it, so you can't spill it. This is my general feel for it, to make the pH meter. So for all of this, it's essentially build a little robot, you know, a fairly intelligent, sufficient robot, which just looks after this little lab, and then you can give it to a kid. So take it home. You've got it there, and so I think the pH solution, yeah, that's big, and it can't be mass produced for certain reasons. So you might look at the moment, it costs a bit over $20 or something like $15 US for one of these things, and sort of a little a blast for the past, and it's sort of uses in got a major use in the pet industry for the pH of fish tanks, etc. So that's where the market is. So it's not a mass market thing, even though it's sort of mass market distribution. It's sort of really hard to sort of nail it. Now, of course, you can well imagine a number of these things. So the idea, obviously, is that I have something, and so students will say, well, why not measure the pH of a solution? I wonder what the pH of this is. I wonder what happens. Their sort of inquiry learning basically is limited by the opportunity and complexity. Yeah, so you've got inquiry unit learning, but once they understand the complexity, and basically all of this is see-through there, so they can see right through to all the electronics and see through what's going on if they're interested in understanding what's going on. So that's the idea of why you cite all the equipment in one piece, and once they've got the template of learning one thing, the next things automatically follow. So essentially up on their phone come up the five temperatures, the pH, the two pressures, and the mass all going on. And you can switch off the pH measurement, you can put things down. So already I'm trying to get that up. So let's just walk through the disaster. I suppose it's not really a disaster, but it sort of shows across my limitations. So I calibrating the thermocouples. There's two aspects to a thermocouple, I can't see how this operates unless the electronics is shit, and that could well be it. So I really have to hold off before I go into it. So what happens is that you get your five thermocouples all reading out, all amazingly reading out, and I'm sort of learning the lesson is don't overanalyze. If it doesn't work with the Arduino, try and load it a second time, a third time. Sometimes it will magically work on the third time through. So if you've got an analytical mind, I suppose like me, who's trying to work things, what's the significance? You've got to cool it and do. So you've got these five things, you plunge it into hot water, and then and this is trying to say research prototype, production prototype, you're sort of one foot on the ground stepping forward. So at the research prototype, you stick it in and you see how these calibrate. And what happens is that basically out of the five, three are absolutely identical, and two one's down by a factor, and one's above by a factor, by a degree, you know, a fraction of a degree, say half a degree, and then one's lower by half a degree, and lower because its multiplier isn't as good. And I find this hard to understand, because a thermocouple is basically a comparison of two things on the periodic table. So it's they're fixed. So that's is it the actual unit, the A to D converter is just shit, and I think that might be it. So before I go in and do it too much, and then I've got the data. Look, the proper thing to do with the data is there's a plover there. So at night we've got these birds, these night birds, which walk around the place and attack you. Yeah, there you go, they attack you. But it's not it's during spring they attack you. But so the idea here is what's that all about? And you can sort of, like, many years ago when I was first doing this, I'd say, oh, I know I have to add this and then I have to do this gradient. But what you do is there's a nonlinear function fitting. It's called the Lev-Mar. Yeah, it's called the Lev-Mar nonlinear approximation. It's just a drop down. But I don't know. I just find it I've done some nonlinear approximation before. I just can't work out how it could possibly work without actually knowing the function you're using to fit. You've got coefficients, and I just find it just one step a bit too hard to understand how it would do it. But that's the best way to do it. The other way is to just go through a process of shift it up. Such as like you go steps, you could shift it such as it's optimized, and then scale it such as it's optimized, then shift it and scale it, shift and scale. Just run it through a few times and you get it spot on. If that makes sense, so you've got a scale error and a shift error, and you just do approximations to do that, and that might well do it as quick as anyone, except it doesn't suit me there. Now we come across to the dreadful tale of, should I spend $5 Australian on one of these sensors? And bit by bit you get a feeling, and what's the overall cost and stuff like that. So these sensors you buy for $5 are the 6625 sensors, as opposed to, okay, so the 6625 is nothing to do with the actual sensor. The sensor is a thermocouple, right? So the idea that the thermocouple doesn't work, it just does my head in. So the 6625, and the 6625 will not go beneath zero. In fact, if you ask it to measure a temperature beneath zero, it has complete hissy fit and takes up 2 hours of your life as you try and de-scramble the Arduino code, because the Arduino code secretes things everywhere. It's sort of like worse than getting an infected computer. If you I just changed from an unsigned integer to integer, and it just completely had a fart attack, and not a heart attack, a fart attack. It just farted everywhere, and to find out where these are secreted and to stop it copying it back in the game, it was just a real effort. So eventually I got it back in, and the chip is shit. 6625, a little bit cheaper, but for $3, for $5, if you know where to look, rather than $10, you can buy the ultimate chip. More bit resolution. Oh, the same bit resolution, but it can go negative, and it's, I don't know, it just seems a better chip. And I shouldn't say, I don't want to bite off too far. It's got the other chip, which I've got, which is the 18 whatever it is, has this, depending on how fast you pulled it, I think it has this thing of undershooting. So it will go, say, say 15 15 15 13.75 14.25 15 15 15. It's got this dip, and I don't think that's of the thermocouple. I think it's the chip is shit. The chip is shit. And you know what's going on there. So there's all these mistakes embedded in, and you basically look at these. Look, it's all fake out of China. You know, how can anything be this cheap anyway? So you get another chip, and you read through. No, this chip is not as specified. And I find this all the time. They're not as specified. This chip actually has an incorrectly, and you have to actually get in and cut a ground line on it. It's sort of like, oh my god! And this is for $3. So it's a bit of the wild. The Wild West. Now, of course, if you put in the positive of the thermocouple into the negative, it will actually read. So as the temperature increases, the voltage will decrease because it's actually increasing back to front. And so once you see, it took a while for me to pick it the first time, the second time, really go across. And then, so I rigorously looked at the plus on the underneath of the board when I was doing servicing of it, so I took the board out because I couldn't see the top one by the way I bound it. So there's a plus and a minus next to the plus and minus terminals, and red is positive, blue is negative. Yeah, that's okay, put it in, and of course if you run it you can see it. But I flipped it over and looked at the plus on this 6625. I'm beginning to really hate them boards. It's just, they're ugly, they're bad put together. I just think they're rubbish, unfortunately. After, I will have to produce, you know, polish this off and produce them. Just means that the next, I keep on, I really thought, you know, I'd produced the concept prototype, and I think this was going to be the end of it. But I just really have to keep on sort of knocking this together. So I turned it over, and of course they've mismarked the back. Like, it's not rocket science. The plus on the back, if you flip it over, is the negative on the other side. I don't know how they've done it. And so you're going, what's this? So, I'm starting to have a bit of, it measures the temperature exquisitely better, possibly better than a more expensive chip, which can go negative. But there's other points, is that you buy it for $3 a bundle of the chip and the thermocouple. Now, the thermocouple, you could say, I do like it. It's in a brass, in a sort of stainless steel tube with the wiring on it, and it's got a huge nut on it. And of course, the huge nut means is that you're trying to put this as a probe, and you're now putting in a huge chunk of metal, so into your beaker. And of course, that's going to change the temperature, and it's going to cause lag. And the thing is not, you know, it's got the responsive time of a turtle. You know, I don't know, it takes a couple of seconds to stabilise at a new temperature, whereas the other probes, which are just basically the raw little junction sticking out there, takes sort of no time whatsoever. Now, it's really interesting that the great thing about this one, it's got sort of auto clips in it, and it's really clear what to do. With it, the other probe is sort of much ready to go. But if I can say what's even worse is that in water the probe begins to rust. So you're thinking, a couple of things. One is it's contaminating the thing you're putting in. If it's rusting, you put in some water, the water turns brown, okay. Oh, so I'm going to have to coat this probe. So $3 and $3 versus $6, a dollar for the wire and the other one does go negative temperature. So the idea that it's got a high thermal mass is one thing. So it's reasonable because obviously they're thinking of screwing that into a gas flow. So the Chinese have obviously, someone said, look, I need to compete with another legitimate European product. I need to make this cheaply. I need it for a particular process. I need it to actually screw this probe in as a heat flow, say for an oven or something. I don't know what you'd use it for. So it's going to be like that. So it's all been specified. And of course, then knocking it off, just factory, just shipping it all over. I'm sure the Chinese economy is going to collapse. Just hard to say. So this is absolute disaster world. And so I suppose I'm nice and very short, but the realization that you've wasted $15 buying 5 cents is just, it's enough to make you cry doing it. But I suppose I've learnt, and so I have to now. What also happened is that I built this up, the prototype one, where you have your Arduino wires. So they have basically a 2 centimeter plastic lug on them, and so you can hold them and position them and stick the actual wire blade in to these little holes. And of course what it means is that these only last so many things. I think they probably last, look, at most 20 times you pull them in and out before they get a bit loose in the tooth. So that's not the way to do it. It's also, you're sticking up now a good, let's say 4 centimeters from the board by the time the wire keels over. So it's just awful. And the Arduino wire is hard to strip. This is the wire in those things. If you say, look, I want to strip up. And so what you have to actually do is you have to get the wire and actually, as it goes in the wire stripper, just as the blades just lightly pinch the outer coating, you have to get the coating and you have to, in your hands, spin it so it scores all around. When it scores all around, it comes off cleanly. Otherwise, it ain't doing it. So, again, I suppose rubbish to get across. And now, I suppose the other thing is that you want to put solder onto a component. So in your circuit board, they have it. They have the material which always stays wet for solder. But if you've got a pin that you want to solder to, that pin oxidizes on the surface. Now, what people tend to do, they've got the little acid brush and they paint it and blow it and dry it off. But what I like to do is actually get in with your engraver and polish it flat. And then within no time, the solder just sticks really on the little spot of metal that you polished up initially. And essentially, you want a nice blob of solder the top there, and a blob of solder on or your wire tinned. Then you press the wire into the area, so there's enough solder there already. You don't have to introduce more solder, and it heats and melts and sticks. And then of course after you've done that, you tuck the buggery out of it and see if you can break them off. You may as well break them off now. So why do I have a disaster on my hand? Well, I had done, I don't know how I did this. I did, there's a clock and a SO signal, which is a common toilet. And I had done this amazing thing where I interchanged the pins in the software and interchanged the pins on the board. So I didn't notice I had interchanged. I made a double error. So I don't know what the likelihood of that is. It's pretty infinitesimal. So when I said, okay, Arduino thing is gone, I'm going to actually build a bespoke plug for this, which looks good, and I can bind it so that you can yank it. So the idea is that you've built these things and you want to hand it to a student, and you don't want it, the student just go, you've got to be able to lock it down. So there's a way of locking it down, but there's a whole series of processes involved. When we look at that, there's a fairly strict way that you can ensure the wires go from one end to the other. And the Arduino just then came on. Data was chundering to the internet, and the data was 0, 0, 0 right across the board. And so what I had to do is that there could be a short. If something wasn't getting through, there could be a short. And so I had to cut off one thing, and then get one, and then go back. It could be the Arduino board that is blown, very unlikely. Then go back, and then back to the original code. Nothing's working. Go back to the original code, and the example code suddenly works. And then go across, and then realize I've swapped it. And then by this time, I've cut up the circuit. It's a real dog's breakfast. And just as well, I haven't spent too much time making it beautiful. I made it robust because I have to turf the whole lot and actually really think through how to do the Arduino board, because you've got this you want to daisy change four wires to the next, and you know in your heart you say, what I really want to do is have one of those, the breadboard that just goes through, you know, obviously the best way is to have a breadboard and it goes through. However, yeah, it's really hard to think about exactly how you're going to do it. So yeah, it's just a bit of a thought on how you're going to do it. So if you line it up such it goes through, the problem is that you face the input of the actual parallel lines that you want to do are also parallel with the lines of where the fiber come out, so you really need to actually put in your cable. Now the other amazing thing is that you can buy this essential new thing for probably $6 Australian. It costs $4 Australian for a compatible plug, a thermocouple plug. I'm sure they're designed, it's specialists, but you know, obviously we can't have that. So that's an overall summary of that debacle going forward. So I hope that's a nice thing and someone might be interested in listening to it. I don't think so. So that's basically trying to get it through. So I will eventually get there. So where I'm up to is five temperatures with absolutely crap chips and thermocouples. They're crap chips because they don't go negative, and they won't go negative. Like it's not going to be worth it trying to explore that longer. They're crap because the thermocouple, if you put it in water, pollutes the water with the rust. It just rusts into normal water. And it's got a huge thermal mass, and you can sort of convince yourself that it's just not going to be worth it. So possibly now you really need five temperature sensors, one for room temperature, and basically you want to be able to put it across an iron bar. You know, put these into an iron bar and pegs in an iron bar, and heat one up. So there's a whole series of experiments that you want to do. That is to get an idea of heat flow and temperature, temperature fly and just get people used to measuring the temperature and pressure of everything. Then we're on the pH, that's nothing, and yeah, at some stage I've got to get on the pressure sensors, but I mean that's really nothing. So that's where I'm up to at the moment, sort of mitigated disaster, and sort of really you got to buy these components and play with them. They're only $3 or whatever it is, but you've got to, you know, sink hours into them before you actually realise it. And there's sort of like, I suppose I could have read the spec sheet, but you know, one wouldn't believe that a thermocouple doesn't read beneath 0 degrees. The chip can't do it, and that's because it's simply not a hobby chip. It's a rip-off chip of some poor industry which is competing. Obviously, probably there's a legitimate person, someone in the West who's getting a rip-off of it, and then it's just disaster to get across. And so possibly tomorrow I'll start the scales, and yeah, there's a few software tricks that I'll be able to put in. I'm already way ahead of the game in terms of people trying to put calibration and all the fuss in your Arduino board, and it's much better to put the intelligence way above. So I just got to think whether you could actually have a keyboard. Oh, she is. Gosh, I just gotta, students wouldn't like that. Okay, thanks a lot for listening. I'm off to the next podcast.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.